This episode of the Preconceived Podcast is brought to you by Speaker Labs. Warren Buffett once said that the number one most important skill in business is public speaking. Speaker Labs helps people become rockstar public speakers. Most people think public speaking is a unique skill that only a select few possess. At Speaker Labs, they disagree. To them, public speaking isn't a unique skill set. It's a unique context for a skill that all humans already possess: communication. If you can communicate, you can public speak. All you need to do is change the way you think. Speaker Labs will show you how. They've trained teams at some of Canada's top companies, including RBC, Shopify, and Wealthsimple. Go to speakerlabs.ca to learn more. And now for another episode of Preconceived. You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives. Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednik, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. Finding a sperm donor can be a challenge. Not only can the process be arduous, but it also costs thousands of dollars. For many, though, finding a sperm donor is the only option for having kids. But what if there was a different option than going through conventional sperm banks to find a donor? Ari Nagel is a mathematics professor in New York. He is also a sperm donor. But as opposed to using traditional sperm banks to offer up his sperm, he gives his sperm for free to women all over the world. He has fathered 70 children to date, spanning from America to Southeast Asia to Africa. So what inspired Ari to become the world's most famous sperm donor? What are his relationships like with the many kids he has fathered and the women to whom he has donated his sperm? And how far does he see this going in the future? Ari, I'm so excited to chat with you. Thanks for joining me.
You bet. I'm so happy to be here. I need to come all the way to Canada and go in the studio. I have clientele there that I'm sure would appreciate the visit.
Absolutely. Have you been to Canada for purposes of the sperm donation? Do you have any kids up here?
No, I don't have any children in Canada, but I do have a woman in Thunder Bay that's pretty persistent, and she's been asking me to come out for 2 years now, except her cycle's irregular, and her English is limited because she's an immigrant there, so it's been a little challenging coordinating, and especially now with the virus, the borders are closed, but I'm sure I will be making it out to Thunder Bay, wherever that is. I'm sure maybe after the podcast, one of your listeners will want a child.
I wouldn't be surprised. And yeah, Thunder Bay is quite remote. I live in Ontario, which is the same province as Thunder Bay, and that still seems quite remote to me. So you're a good man for going out there. Ari, what made you get into this? How did this develop, becoming such a part of your life, sperm donation?
I have a 16-year-old that wasn't part of a donation. I certainly loved being a father to him, and I'm from a big family, so I wanted a big family. But of course, as my family grew, I think my motivation has transitioned maybe into helping myself grow my family, really, to helping women experience that same joy. So once you have a boy and you have a girl, and then you have two boys and two girls, at a certain point that, you know, I don't really need to grow my family anymore. So maybe what started my motivation was not only to help other women grow their families, but also to grow mine, I think transitioned to, at this point, really, I'm just helping women grow their families.
So you have a kid that was not a sperm donation, but when you were initially doing your first sperm donations, were those in the spirit of you trying to create your own family, just in a bit of an unconventional way?
Yeah, I would probably say maybe it was more a combo. So, you know, maybe along the lines of a 50-50 kind of split where, you know, I was from a big family and I wanted to have more children. Certainly, I enjoyed being a father. And then when this it's actually my, I have a 12-year-old, which was from a lesbian couple that was asking me for help in growing their family. And then there was also a single woman that was in her 40s who was asking me to help grow their family. So these two kids are around the same age. Of course, one's living in Israel and one's living in Chelsea. One has African-American lesbian parents and one has an Orthodox Jew as a mom. And one is Christian and one's Jewish. I mean, when you look at the way these two 12-year-olds are growing up, they really have literally nothing in common. The only thing they do have in common is they're the same age and then they have the same father. But those were really my first two donations that I helped. And they're both, one's 12 and one's turning 12 next month. one has like long dreadlocks and the other one has long side curls, as Hasidic Jews often do. So they haven't met yet, although of course I've met them both. And I think after that, it was, you know, other lesbian couples heard what I did, or ex-girlfriends heard what I did. So the vast majority of the families that I help grow are either lesbians or single women. Of course, there's other families, including heterosexual couples or trans couples, but the vast majority of them are lesbians or single women that were just getting a little older and weren't finding Mr. Right, or just wanted to start a family on their own.
How does this work? If a party's party sounds very formal. If a woman is interested in having you as their sperm donor, they just get in touch with you, and how does the process go from there?
Yeah, well, it varies, because it really depends on what their age is. So obviously, if they're in their 40s, we may want to go the route of the clinic. Sometimes that involves travel. If they have insurance, I would just use a local clinic near them. If they don't have health insurance that covers fertility, as is often the case, because most states in the U.S. do not mandate any kind of fertility coverage, so then we would explore options outside of the U.S. where the fertility treatments are considerably cheaper. So the vast majority of the time I'm traveling out of the country, it's often just for women in the United States who are just traveling outside the United States for medical tourism. So that's basically women in their 40s. If they're in their 20s or 30s, then more often than not, we're just doing it on our own. They would track their cycle. Maybe they would buy ovulation tests, which are around 10 cents each. They test each day, see when they're testing positive, and then we would meet. And we would meet each month until they're pregnant. Of course, it varies depending where they are in the U.S. So if they're in New York or New Jersey or Connecticut or Pennsylvania, then they would just be using ovulation tests to see when they test positive, and then we meet up. If they're from out of state, then they would need to track their cycle. They download a free app and enter when their period starts each month. And then once they see when they're ovulating, we would try and price out a cheap ticket so that we can meet each month when they're ovulating. I have in some circumstances mailed my sperm, and it does work. I have a daughter in Illinois that was conceived through the mail. It was a different situation. It was a heterosexual couple, and they wanted to keep the distance. I think maybe the father was less comfortable with me showing up to the town and helping them conceive. So we did it via the mail. I do get a lot of requests if I could just mail my sperm here or mail my sperm there. But I find it does work better in person. And in some ways, it's also nicer. And it's not any more expensive. For example, a flight sometimes costs around the same as the overnight shipping. But the vast majority of the time, the women are spending less than a dollar to help conceive, because they're in the tri-state area and we just meet up when they're ovulating.
How much would it typically cost for people to undergo the sperm donation process if they wanted to get sperm from a traditional sperm bank?
Well, only 16 states in the United States mandate any type of fertility coverage. But even if you do have fertility coverage, it's not including the sperm. The sperm is not included. And more often than not, we would have to lie when we go to the clinic, because we would have to pretend that we're partners. If they were using a known donor, very often insurance wouldn't even cover it. But of course, insurance rarely covers it, although the states that do mandate some type of fertility coverage would be New York and New Jersey and Connecticut, all states that are in the Northeast. The problem is that that's only if they have insurance through their employer, Medicaid. If they have the public health option, obviously does not cover any fertility coverage. But that's the big no. Otherwise, what would it cost if they had insurance? Certainly the sperm itself would still cost $1,000. So I'm certainly saving them at least that. Don't have insurance, as is often the case, then it would be a few thousand dollars. If you do IUI, the chances of it working is really only 8%. I mean, if you go to the fertility clinic, purchase sperm, and then do donation, which is the typical fertility technique that most women use, it only has an 8% chance of working. So you think, all right, well, if they don't have $1,000 for IUI, then they shouldn't be having children, because children are expensive. But not understanding that they're not just going to have to buy one vial of sperm. It only works 8% of the time when you go to the clinic. With medication, it works 15% of the time. That's assuming no complications. That's doing in uterine insemination. If you do IVF, then obviously the costs are closer to around $10,000 or $15,000, especially when you include meds. It really depends what they need. The $1,000 that they're buying for the sperm, if they're doing IUI, which only works 8% of the time, feasibly they would have to do at least 5 or 6 cycles in order to get it to work. So a lot of the women that reach out to me for help already exhausted all of their funds. in the fertility clinic. And then after they ran out of money, that's when they're reaching out to me and say, all right, listen, we wanted to go the fertility clinic way and the option that everyone accepts, but we just ran out of money. And obviously the money that they save will just help them better able to support the children or the forthcoming children. So any money I could save them just puts them in a better position to help support the child.
So you have 70 kids now. At this point, is the main motivation has become really just to help people because you're doing a service that you deem is important and generous?
Yes. People ask me, how many kids do I want to have? Yeah, I certainly don't need my 71st child. But of course, this woman that's expecting next month, it's her first child. So for her, she doesn't care how many children I have. She wants her one.
What's your relationship like with the majority of these women?
You're talking around 70 women, so there's going to be varied relationships. Some I'm quite close with, some I don't know very well. Some of them I met once, some of them I've never met, so it varied. I do think that even the ones that I don't see often, there's a lot of love. I mean, certainly they are in love with their child, and they see a little of me in that child, so I get to be the recipient of a lot of love as well. They know how much joy I brought them. Of course, obviously, there's exceptions. So I have very, very close relationships, I would say, with 90% of the moms. We've never fought even once. Of course, I'm letting them make 100% of the decisions. So there's very little that we can fight about. Obviously, there's nothing to fight about. I love the child. They love the child. They get to choose the name. And then every subsequent decision after that.
Is there a contract in place or something? Are there responsibilities that are kind of outlined that it's you're giving them your sperm, but then afterwards, are there certain expectations, or is it just I'm going to be however you want me to be, however I want to be, however the child wants me to be involved in their life?
I have a lot of flexibility. So for a lot of the children, I'm always leaving it up to the mom. So the moms have 100% of the decision making. Some of them don't want me involved at all, but sometimes that changes and then they want me to play a bigger role, and then I try and step up to the plate and do my best to, you know, play a positive role in their life. So it's dynamic. It's changing all the time. There's also the moms that wanted me to play a role and then they change their mind. So it goes back and forth, and I always leave it up to the moms so that I'll play whatever role that they want. Obviously, when the kids are older, they have different views. I mean, what if I have a preteen and they're not getting along with the mom, and then they want to say, listen, I want to live with dad. Obviously, that could pose a challenge. It would be a difficult decision, but I think ultimately I would always try and honor the mother's wishes. That goes the same if one of the mothers die, right? So ultimately, I probably would have rights to the child, but I would just try and honor and respect the mother's wishes. As far as there being a contract, I never required a contract, but sometimes they come to me with a contract that they want me to sign, and I'll just sign whatever contract that they're comfortable with. In the end, ultimately, we never use the contracts, so I'm happy for them to, if they change their mind in the future and then they want to change the contract, that's okay.
So do you view yourself, and I'm sure the answer to this isn't a black and white, as categorical a question as I'm making it sound, but do you view yourself more as their father or as a sperm donor who gets to know them as well sometimes?
Ultimately, in the end, that mostly depends on the moms and what role they see me in. So some of the kids call me Ari, and some of them call me Dad. Most of them do call me Dad, and then some of them don't call me at all. There's some kids that I've never met, right? So it varies. A lot of times there's two moms, obviously, in the picture, and one of them sort of plays the dominant, maybe aggressive type father type role, where there's maybe a stud and a femme in the relationship. So one does seem a little bit more masculine and maybe is more of a father figure. Of course, there's also heterosexual couples that I helped where the children already have a father. So, you know, obviously I'm not playing a role of raising that child. But a lot of times there's families, even if I have nothing to do with them, maybe that they have the child be close with their siblings and their brothers and sisters. So sometimes if they're out of state, even if I don't get together that often, a lot of the kids, sometimes the moms reach out to me. They were a little too old to maybe have a larger family, but they don't want the kid to be an only child. So they're very excited by the prospect of having their child foster relationships with their brothers and sisters. So some of the kids get together with their brothers and sisters a lot more often than maybe they would with their father.
Ari, how do you keep track of 70 kids? I mean, it's tough to keep track of 70 friends. At least for me, if I even have 70 people I'd really call true friends. So to have 70 kids, even with varying relationships, how do you kind of cognitively and emotionally have the bandwidth for that? Especially when they get older and there's potential for perhaps a more in-depth relationship of sorts.
Certainly, you know, when my boss found out how many kids I had, she called me into her office, and she's almost more like a mother than she is a boss. And that was her take. She said, listen, the kids are young now. So, you know, they scrape their knee, you give them a lolly. Most problems can be solved with a little bit of candy. But as they get older, those relationships and those problems are a lot more complex, and maybe they won't be as easy. You know, sometimes you're overwhelmed with diaper changes and you think, oh, well, you know, when they're infants, that's the hardest. But there's light at the end of the tunnel when they're 2 or 3 years old, and then, you know, they'll be more independent. They can dress themselves. Things would get easier. But then it also can sometimes get more complicated. So she was concerned that maybe when these kids get older, it'll be a little bit more challenging. I'm sure that will be the case. I suspect that it's just a matter of time before some of the children may resent maybe the fact that I have so many children. But in the end, ultimately, I think I'm not really replacing a full-time father. What I'm trying to do my best at replacing is maybe the mothers having to use an anonymous frozen sperm bank where the donor is completely anonymous and the child will never know who the father is. So when you look at it from that aspect, you know, obviously it's not just the money angle. A lot of these women just didn't feel comfortable with choosing who the father of their child's going to be. Maybe one of the most important decisions that they'll make in their entire life. And then having to make that decision without even ever meeting who that person's going to be. So you're looking at a piece of paper and you see very, very superficial things. And maybe you see a little essay that the person wrote, which could have been copied and pasted. I mean, you almost really don't know the person at all. You can't have a cup of coffee with the person. Whereas here, it's not just the mother that's struggling with that decision, but I think children struggle for the rest of their lives when they have this anonymous donor and they don't know who their father is. And they look around and they see men and they say, maybe that's my dad. And I think they have identity issues.
So from your perspective then, if some of these kids do end up being resentful that how did you have 100 kids? I'm just one of 100 kids. So you're saying, well, what would the alternative have been? The alternative would have been kind of you don't exist, obviously, or you'd have an anonymous sperm donor that you'd potentially never even have the capability of meeting. So you trust that in a way they'll be able to grapple with that and come to terms with the fact, well, yeah, I guess I'd rather have a father that is not anonymous than an anonymous sperm donor that I'd never even have the opportunity of meeting and then developing a connection with.
The vast majority of the donor-conceived children that were polled, I think, certainly would have preferred that they had known the child. That being said, I think the vast majority of donor-conceived children would also prefer that their donor father didn't have so many kids so that they'd be able to foster a stronger relationship, because a lot of times the donor allows their identity to be known after the child turns 18, and then the child finds out that they have all these brothers and sisters, and even if they wanted to foster a relationship with their parent, it's not as feasible because you know, they have to share their time among so many brothers and sisters. But in some ways, I think perhaps what they're losing from having a full-time father or even a father that they could be super close with, maybe they're gaining so many brothers and sisters and they'd be able to have close relationships with them. Of course, those relationships will be for life, whereas a parent relationship is only until they're 40 or 50 years old. You know, obviously the kids that I'm expecting in this upcoming year, you know, I'm not going to be there for them their whole life, but their brothers and sisters will be.
Do you get pride when you see your kids? Like, do you look at these 70 kids and do you look at them as you would a traditional child? I mean, you do have a traditional child. You have a kid who I believe you said is 15?
16. He'll be 17 September 12th. And, you know, it's funny because you asked me, how do I keep track of 70 kids? And then obviously I have some more on the way. And the truth is you know, I have 70 students a semester. But at the end of the 12-week semester, I do know all of their names, you know, and I'm sure you have 70 patients and you probably have close relationships with many of them as well. I think just the fact that I have 70 children doesn't necessarily mean that I don't know their names or birthdays or know their mom's names and, it, you know, don't feel close to them.
How does your 16-year-old feel about this? And do you have a different relationship with him than you do with a lot of the other kids?
Yeah. You know, speaking to your other question, I just realized, you know, I'm not 100% sure I'm doing the right thing. Obviously, time will tell. I certainly feel that way now, but I understand I'm basically making it up as I go along. So it's very possible that mistakes would have been made, you know, but I'm doing my best. Certainly, it feels like I'm doing the right thing in my heart of hearts. And I'm certainly seeing the joy of the moms and of our children. Do I take pride in the children? Obviously, of course I do. You know, not will I take pride, but I do. Just even the every year I have graduations. Of course, it's just mostly kindergarten graduations or lower school graduations, middle school graduations. They're not major accomplishments, but I look forward and I'm sure many of my kids will go on to do great things. Also pretty confident that, you know, it's going to go both ways. I mean, will one of my kids, you know, spend time in a penitentiary, or will any of them be arrested, or will any of them be a drug addict? I mean, all of those are obviously possibilities when you have so many children. So far, they're doing very well, but, you know, you really can't tell. The moms are so capable, and I'm hopeful that won't be the case, and that they'll all be contributing members to society, but, you know, you never really know. That being said, what does my son feel? You know, for this homeschooling this past year, he did very, very little. But then in last week, when June came and all those deadlines approached, he had to write a lot of papers. And he did write one of the papers, and part of it was how he felt about having so many brothers and sisters. He writes better than I do, so I won't do it justice. But, you know, I think he's quite easygoing. So I don't think he's really certainly not resenting what I'm doing. You know, in some ways he feels a lot of responsibility because he has, you know, a lot of kids do look up to their big brother as well. I told him he has to do good on his SATs. Otherwise nobody's going to want my sperm anymore. Yeah. So I don't think he felt the pressure. He understood the humor, but I do think that, you know, he does know that a lot of kids, and a lot of them do, you know, he's met more than half of his brothers and sisters, and I know that his younger brothers and younger sisters, especially the ones that feel close to him, do look at him as a role model. And then not only that, but the women that have met him, you know, he feels like maybe he's the poster child for a service, you know, that I'm providing.
It sounds like you obviously have a close relationship with him. Do you feel a different sense of responsibility as a father with him? Because you are that more traditional father with him. Whereas with these other kids, it's not really that's the case all the time.
You know, in the end, ultimately, I feel a responsibility to help the ones that need it. It's based on need. Of course, he's doing well and he's a teenager and we have a very close relationship. In the end, ultimately, I feel a lot of responsibility to try and help in any way I can. Maybe the kids that I feel could really, really use it. Sometimes I feel like the moms that are struggling, sometimes they're single moms that are struggling. So I feel a little bit more responsibility to try and do my best to help them. Of course, that's not really the case for the vast majority of them who just handle it, you know, but any little bit that I can do, I do my best. I had a mom that had a stroke last December. So she wasn't really asking me for help, but I wasn't popping in to visit the child very much before she had the stroke. She was handling everything just fine. But now she's a little unsteady on her feet and it's a little difficult for her to get out. So I do feel a little bit more of a responsibility to do the best I can to maybe step up to the plate and try and help a little bit more than I have been. And of course, financially, I'm not in a position to do much, but you know, if I can help her out with a case of diapers here and there, or sometimes just co-sign a loan or something along those lines, even if it's not just financially supporting her, sometimes it's just even as much as, you know, taking her out and taking her and the kid to the park. So I feel more of a responsibility, I think, for the moms that need the help more than so much the ones that perhaps were conceived in the more traditional sense.
Ari, I'm sure it's no surprise to you that a lot of people who've heard your story, and I'm sure a lot of people listening right now on this podcast, have polarizing opinions about this. What are some of the negative reactions you've encountered, and how do you kind of respond to those?
You know, the vast majority of the women that are reaching out to me are just women that want sperm. So I'm sure there's people posting comments online, perhaps, of dislike what I'm doing. Of course, obviously, they never met me, and they certainly never met any of the children. They never met any of the moms. So I'm not 100% sure what they're basing their opinion on. I think probably if they met the families that I helped grow, perhaps they'd feel differently. Of course, the vast majority of the time, the newspapers aren't going to report on the inspirational stories of the women who struggled for many, many years to help grow their family, and they were able to have a child after so many years of trying and so many failed attempts.
Do people ever refer to you as egocentric, maybe, or think that you're doing this because you just have this obsession with yourself in terms of passing on your sperm, and that from an evolutionary standpoint, for example, you are trying to excel in that regard? Is that something that people ever accuse you of? And I say accuse, I'm not even sure if that's an accusatory thing. Technically, from an evolutionary standpoint, you are excelling. You are spreading your seed more effectively than anybody else.
Yeah, well, you know, I think my father had 7 children. I don't think anyone accused him, you know, after the 7th child, of like, what are you trying to do? You have too many. In the end, ultimately, you can't really focus on random people's opinions. I think what I really need to focus on is the people that I care about. Certainly the mothers, and their opinion very much matters to me. And certainly they support what I'm doing. And obviously my immediate family, my brothers and sisters and my parents, their opinion very much matters to me, even if it differs quite a bit with my own. I think in many ways, my parents are very ashamed of what I've done. I don't think they accuse me of being egocentric because they know me well, and I don't think they believe that's the case. Ultimately, the people that would accuse me of being egocentric are more likely than not people that haven't met me. But I struggle with whether I'm doing the right thing, certainly.
And was that a pretty conventional family you grew up in?
Yeah, my parents are married over 50 years. And I have 4 brothers and 2 sisters that are all married and have children in very, very traditional relationships. Of course, I know that's my parents' hope for me, that I too will one day settle down and start a family of my own in a more traditional manner. I think they're very ashamed because they live in a very, very insular, ultra-Orthodox community that's quite religious and doesn't really accept in many ways the modern family. I mean, my parents are in their 70s, so they probably have different views of you know, what a family should be. They don't have a close relationship with my children. They've met some of them, and I think they're more open to meeting some than others. My father, I think, is a little more open, perhaps, than my mom. You know, of course, I think he doesn't want to rock the boat, so in many ways, he goes along with what my mother feels. But I had a circumcision 2 weeks ago, and my dad came. My mother didn't. She didn't feel comfortable. But for most of the children, they don't have any relationship at all.
Do you have any desire to have a more, I mean, it's kind of tough to have a more traditional family when you're at the stage you're at, but do you have the desire to get married or have a long-term partner with whom you have multiple kids?
I turned 45 last month, so I'm not going to be, you know, helping women grow their families, you know, forever. I certainly don't see myself doing this in my 50s. It's impossible to be in a relationship while continue to help growing other women's families. I mean, I don't want to say impossible, but it's almost unfair.
So is that a part of your life that you've kind of accepted is going to be challenging, at least right now?
There's trade-offs, certainly, you know, but I'm not lacking the love in my life. I have a lot of love in my life, certainly, even if it's not of the romantic variety. Of course, there is the physical love, which, honestly, even though I'm not in a relationship, I get a lot of offers for intimate physical relationships because a lot of the women that I'm helping are not lesbians, and they don't want to conceive in any other way and would prefer to do it the old-fashioned way. It's a little challenging for me because if I'm helping more than one woman at a time, it's a little difficult for me to have unprotected sex with more than one woman. Of course, I'm also ejaculating quite a bit, so I don't really have the desire as much to pursue a relationship. You know, that's just the nature of the beast. However, of course, I have a lot of good close friends, including the one that I'm visiting right now. So I think ultimately it's a temporary limitation.
On a more broad level, do you kind of view the paradigm of what it means to be a family a bit differently? Does this reflect some greater view of yours regarding how society should be and how maybe families could function differently and how maybe we can operate as a society, as communities, a little bit differently and a little bit more together, as opposed to having these sharp, traditionally delineated family structures.
What's interesting is that I had an amazing childhood from a traditional family. So I'm not proposing, you know, eliminating that option. That's just a terrific option. That being said, I look at some of my children, and as much as I love my dad and all those bedtime stories that he shared with me, you know, ultimately my mom did most of the heavy lifting. And then I look at my kids, and so many of them have two moms, and I'd be like, that's really, you know, just fantastic. I think that's so great for the child. And sometimes they have two moms and a dad, because I'm in the picture as well. Ultimately, in the end, I think the more people that love the child, the better. There's all kinds of modern families. I think society more or less accepted two moms and two dads. So I'm not so sure it's such a big stretch to maybe do two moms and a dad. I think there's a lot of families, obviously, where there's a heterosexual couple and the mom and the dad don't get along. I certainly think that this option that I'm providing would be better than that. I think some people are meant to be great moms, but maybe not meant to be great spouses. And I think that's true for some men as well. You know, for the vast majority of the moms, we never fought, not once. Literally, we never had one disagreement. And I think that's great for the child to never see their parents fight. I think ultimately, in the end, the two people that this child loves most in the world are their mom and their dad. And when you have relationships, maybe in the traditional family, where the parents don't get along, as happens in half the cases, right? When you look at the divorce rate, but certainly I think the option that I'm providing probably would be a better option than maybe that, where there's no custody battles. There's no court cases. It's traumatic for a child to see their parents fight. So I'm proud that my kids don't have to view that.
Rarely on the podcast do I have an episode that really just challenges the preconceived like this does. You've really said, I'm going to follow my own path and charter my own course. That takes a lot of courage. Were you always somebody who, when you were living your life, kind of said, I'm just going to do things the way that make intuitive sense to me, as opposed to following the predetermined path? This must be in keeping, I imagine, with your personality at large, because it surely is a departure from the norm. But you understand why you're doing it. You've articulated why, and you've just gone for it, as opposed to saying, oh, society doesn't do this, so I'm not going to do this.
You know what society accepts? Society accepts a woman going to a sperm bank, choosing an anonymous donor, and then having the child never meet that father. But somehow that became the accepted route. I think IVF is such a new feature, and because it really wasn't around 100 years ago. And I think it has some evolving to do before people realize that that's just not a good option, not for the mom, not for the child. And I was a middle child. So certainly my parents, you said it much more eloquently than they would describe it. But my mother never really had anything positive to say about what I'm doing. Although she did once say that it took a lot of courage, certainly.
If women are hearing this and interested, you must have a big backlog. There must be tons of people reaching out to you. But how do people get in touch with you? Or do you want people still getting in touch with you in regards to this?
Yeah, I have women pregnant right now, as we speak, in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Texas, and California. So I have women expecting, and of course, these women, obviously, it's altering their whole lives. This is the most important thing that's ever happened to them, and they couldn't be more excited. Where do people reach out to me? Yeah, sometimes it's challenging. You have two women that are ovulating on the same day, and then you have to decide who you're going to help. So you have to make the decision of, well, one woman might be 39 years old and is running out of time, but very, very unlikely to conceive because she has a lot of complications, because she may have fibroids and PCOS. And then you might have a younger woman who's very fertile, but postponing her to the next month maybe isn't so traumatic, but she doesn't care. She doesn't want to hear that. For her, this is the most important thing, and it's a challenge sometimes. Figuring out, obviously, I could ejaculate twice in one day, but that makes it a little challenging because the person who gets the second sample of the day won't have as much sperm, so it's not as likely. So you have to take into account whether maybe they're on meds, which obviously if they started a medicated cycle, I want to make sure to help them. Sometimes if they're spending a lot of money on some fertility treatments, I want to abstain the day before, but I might have someone that wants sperm and I'd have to tell them, listen, I don't want to ejaculate today because I have an IVF the following day and I want to give this woman the best chance possible. Sometimes it's best to abstain really for 2 days prior to ejaculating, so it'll be the maximum count. So if I have only 24 hours in between ejaculations, there won't be as much sperm as if I had 48 hours or 72 hours. Obviously, this law of diminishing returns, the longer that it is, sometimes the motility goes down. So if you're more than 7 days, so the happy medium is you don't want to ejaculate too recently, but also not too long. You don't want too much time to pass because otherwise they won't swim as well. Because of that, it makes it a little challenging being able to help. And sometimes you postpone people and say, listen, I really can't help you this month, so let's wait another month. Sometimes they're traveling great distances. 2 days ago, I flew to Florida to help a woman who was ovulating yesterday. Of course, that same day that I was flying out, I had a woman from Maryland who said she was ovulating. So she wanted to meet me at the airport in New Jersey. So she drove 3 hours to meet me at the airport before I flew out. She said she hit a little bit of traffic and I had a flight to catch. So she was trying to get me to miss my flight. Of course, then I would have missed this couple in Boca. So I said, there's no way I'm going to miss this flight. I have a woman who's ovulating in Boca Raton and she's going to reimburse me for this flight and I'm not going to miss it. So she said, can you just go to the bathroom in the airport, put your sperm in a cup and just leave it there. And I'll be there within the hour and I'm going to pick it up and then I'll put it inside. Of course, she was just desperate and it made no sense. She's young. She has plenty of time, but she was already like 2.5 hours into her 3 hour journey. And she was like, listen, I don't want to miss this cycle. So that was just this week, but that happens all the time.
Did you do it then?
I did not do it because it turns out that she was not even ovulating, even though I didn't find that out till later, but her test was blinking. It really should have been solid. She was telling me that she was at peak fertility. And she admitted to this to me afterwards. Her test is still flashing. She had a couple more days. And then also, I already know that the custodian was going to throw out my sperm. I'm not leaving my sperm. And then the real reason I didn't do it is because I was flying to Florida and I wanted to make sure that that woman there had the best opportunity. I did have a situation where I was at a friend's birthday party and I was meeting a couple who was coming from pretty far away. And they were on their way driving, but I also made plans to babysit my son for the weekend. And I was picking him up from Connecticut. So I'm at my friend's party and I said, listen, you're running late, but I already told the mom I'm going to meet her halfway because she's driving from Connecticut. I was going to drive from New York City and we're going to meet halfway in between. I said, I can't wait for you. But they were already in the car on the way from Long Island. So I said, listen, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll leave it here at the party and then you'll come to the party. You'll pick up the cup of sperm and you'll put it inside. So I went to the bathroom and with a red Solo cup that everyone was drinking from. And I produced my sample. I put it into the cup. I came back to the party. I put the cup down and these were my friends. I said, listen, nobody drink from this cup. There's going to be a lesbian couple. They'll be here in an hour. They're going to pick up my sperm. Of course, this is so funny because my friends who all high five me and appreciate what I'm doing and laugh about it and we kid around about it and are always taking pride in how many children I have. But as soon as I put this cup of sperm down and then they were going to like getting very, very queasy about it. They're like, wait a minute, do we have to pick up the cup and give it to her? Is she going to come out of the car and take it? Anyway, they came in their pickup truck and then they get to the party and they pick up this red Solo cup and they go in the back of their pickup and put the sperm inside and they ended up getting pregnant. And what's interesting is that so she was walking around pregnant with my baby, but this is a woman that I've never met. So she never met me. I never met her, but then here she is pregnant with my child. Of course, subsequently, that child's 3. That's an old story. So we've met many times.
Ari, this is fascinating. Thank you so much for taking this time to talk with me. I'm waiting for the surge in 15, 20 years of math wizards as your children.
And yeah, well, you know what? I could give you a math problem. See, I have a a dozen in the oven. And then, of course, I have 70 children already born. So if each of my kids have the same number of kids that I had, and then each of their kids have the same number of kids that I have, and we do that just for two generations, then there'll be 500,000 great-grandkids.
Wow.
Of course, obviously, my 35 daughters are not going to be having, 82 children.
Probably not. That's a pretty safe bet.
My 16-year-old son, as well as we get along, he sees the struggles I have, and I'm not so, he certainly does not. I tease him about it all the time. Because they call me the Sperminator. I said, listen, they'll call you the Ejaculator. You could take on a new moniker and you could take over. I'm ready to retire and you're just young and in your prime. Maybe you want to step up to the plate. But even though I tease him about it, he has no interest in filling my shoes. But I did bring a lot of awareness to the different reproductive options that women have. Certainly, I think there's really a lot of men doing the exact same thing, maybe not as involved with the children as I am, perhaps, but of course, a lot of guys are helping women conceive. Of course, some of them are doing it for, easy action, obviously, even though I would propose that there's easier ways to get action than helping women conceive. But I'm sure many of them are doing it for altruistic reasons. But I think what's more rare about my situation is maybe they're not as actively involved, perhaps, in the children's lives. They're doing it more as a donor, a known donor. But there's many, many Facebook groups. So certainly if any of the men listening to this podcast want to help women grow their families, they could join, a sperm donor Facebook group. There's hundreds of them. A lot of them were started by guys who maybe might delete other men in their city just so that they could be the only one, but then certainly wouldn't care if other men joined in other cities. So there's weird things going on in the Facebook group. But there's an app called Just the Baby, which is quite nice. And that's not run by donors. It's, I think, just an app that you could download, and then you'd be able to search for women. It's almost like a Tinder where you swipe left, swipe right, and it's a free app, and you'd be able to find women who are looking for help to grow their families. There's a website called Known Donor Registry, which also is free. I'm not really against women using donor sperm, even anonymous donor sperm. I think it's a service that maybe a lot of women feel comfortable with. They prefer to go that option. Sometimes women choose me. I was once with a woman from New Mexico, and we're chatting at her hotel because there was free breakfast. And I get a call from the Associated Press, and they were asking me all sorts of questions, much like you were. And then I said, hey, I have this woman from New Mexico. Would you like to talk to her, and ask her any questions? And they were like, yes, of course, we'd love to. And then, of course, I don't really ask too many questions of the women that reach out to me for help. So I handed the phone over to her, and they said, why did you choose Ari to be the father of your children? And here I thought she was going to say, oh, well, he has blue eyes, or oh, he's very tall, or he's good at math, and I want my kids to be good at math, or maybe it's because I have a big heart, and they want their children to have a big heart. But in the end, she said, the reason I chose him because he lives far away, and I don't want anyone nearby. I didn't want anyone in my city. I didn't want anyone knowing. I liked him because he was 2,000 miles away. So people choose me for all sorts of reasons. Obviously, probably being free certainly is one of them. I've never charged any of these women, but the reasons vary, I think, depending on the woman.
I was chatting with my friend that I was doing this podcast today, and I joked. I said, "Nobody would want my sperm. I'm 5'3". You're over 6 feet. That's a big draw, I imagine."
I did this TV show last summer, and it was called "To Tell the Truth." And what happens is me and two actors go on stage, and they say, okay, let's welcome the guy with 70 kids. He helps other women around the world grow their families. And then there's like a celebrity panel that has to ask you questions and then determine who's the real guy with 70 kids and who are the two actors that are pretending to be me. So you have two actors that are pretending to be me, and then there was me. So the problem is, whoever did the casting, they got a really short Italian guy to play one of the imposters, right?
And people are like, nah, this guy isn't the one they're choosing.
Exactly. We made our job a lot more difficult, even if he had all the answers. And then, of course, they had this really tall guy who quite a few people voted for. But it was a funny show.
Well, Ari, thanks again. Really, really fascinating chatting with you. I don't know you well, but you sound like you have a really, really big heart and you're really helping a lot of people. So all the kudos to you for that. I think it's incredible how you've taken a journey and really charted your own path in this world.
Great. And if you want to have another guest, you could get my son on for six, but he's going to want like $100 because he's tired of the $100 I buy him. So yeah. Well, it was a pleasure chatting with you. I really enjoyed.
Thanks a lot, Ari. And thank you everybody for listening to another episode of Preconceived, and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Preconceived. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you use, and be sure to rate and review us. We'll see you next time.